Welcome to the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, brought to you by the Society of Addiction Psychology. Today we're going to have Keenan Joyner join us. Keenan is a doctoral student at Florida State University. He's a Ford Predoctoral Fellow. He's the training chair for the Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction 2021 conference and a past member of both the diversity committee and member of the student trainee planning committee for the 2019 and 2020 Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction conference. Very active in the Society of Addiction Psychology. And we're really excited to have our Keenan join us for our first student episode. Today, Keenan's going to be talking a lot about his research, what he's focused on, primarily in the area of alternative engagement, but also the importance of multiple measurement approaches, and in his case, specifically, psychophysiology research. All right. Well, we're really excited to have you on the show, Keenan. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here, guys.
Yeah. Thanks for taking some time out of your day. We'd like to hear about people's training before we really get into the juice of what they want to talk about. So can you tell us a little bit about your training so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am currently a six-year doctoral student at Florida State. It started way back, actually, obviously, Sam knows, with Sam's current doctoral advisor, Jim Murphy. Got a shout out. Jim, University of Memphis when I was an undergrad. So I started there and I was at University of Memphis for undergrad and then went to Florida State for grad school, and I've been there and I'm just getting close to finishing up there. So I've had a really great training experience. My current advisor is Chris Patrick. He's perhaps most well known for his work on psychopathic personality rather than addiction. But he's been a huge player in the field of kind of externalizing models and, particularly behavioral genetics and psychophysiology. So that's where a lot of my current work is also looking at kind of psychophysiological correlates of addictive behaviors, particularly alcohol and drug use, as well as some behavioral genetics aspects. So when I talk about behavioral genetics, I'll be talking about twin studies. So monozygotic versus dizygotic twins. As well as, of course, I've kept my behavioral economic bend as well, in collaboration with Jim and others. That's kind of what's brought me to this point so far.
Awesome. And Chris Patrick is also well known as a drummer, if I understand correctly, right?
So every so often he'll hop on the drums, but he's mostly actually a guitar guy.
Okay.
Think you're thinking of Bruce Bartholow.
Well, Bruce, see, that's funny.
Tears it up on the drums.
That's funny because I talked to Bruce and we had this long conversation about a guitar a while ago, and so I remembered that they played together, but I guess I had them switched in my mind.
Yeah, so SPR, Society for Psychophysiological Research, they have this great blues band that plays every year at the last night of the conference. And so Chris Patrick is usually up there. Bruce Bartholow is always up there. And so people get into it. It's usually a really great time.
Yeah, I'll have to attend that conference at some point. So Keenan, I know your research really well. We've done a bit together, but also just vicariously through Jim, I've experienced a lot of, heard a lot about what's been going on, but I'd like to hear a little bit about, about your research and what you're working on these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So, my research, I think you could broadly, describe it as, I'm really interested in, understanding a comprehensive account of, the etiology of human addiction. So that starts very at the basic point of kind of, as I mentioned, behavioral genetics work. So trying to understand kind of what are factors that are passed from parent to child. We know addiction runs in families, and there's certainly a genetic component to it. So starting all the way back at that point, And then going through what are kind of the basic traits and trait dispositions that exist in individuals at risk for addiction, such as, you know, children of people who have struggled with addiction, kind of what do they look like in terms of basic trait terms? And then you kind of have, you know, I would describe traits as very distal from the outcome that you know, the phenomenon that we often like to study and we care about preventing and treating, which is the actual addiction. But then I'm also interested in something much more proximal. So what comes in between the trait that is very probabilistic, kind of far away, quote unquote, from the addictive phenotype, and then something that's much closer to it. And so that's where a lot of my behavioral economics research comes into play. I think behavioral economics is a very interesting way to quantify factors that you might describe as close, quote unquote, to addiction. So something like drug demand. So, you know, you can generate these demand curves using alcohol purchase tasks, cigarette purchase tasks, marijuana purchase tasks, these types of things. They're supposed to be human analogs to the kind of animal literature on demand for drugs. That's kind of come out of like an operant conditioning type framework. And you can talk about, you know, basically somebody's demand being elastic or inelastic. So I'm not really willing to modulate my drinking in response to contingencies such as price or other available alternatives. We'd say that person is at high risk for having a lot of problems due to alcohol. And that's something that's very close to alcohol because you're, in fact, invoking the phenotype that you're interested in explaining. So you're interested in explaining problems with alcohol, and we're then going to ask questions about their behavior surrounding alcohol. So it's like one step removed from the actual phenotype that we're interested in. And so my research is really trying to get a handle on how can we conceptualize all the way from the very start, quote unquote, of somebody's life. We're thinking about inherited predispositions to certain types of tendencies, certain personality characteristics, all the way through something that's very proximal to the problem of interest, something like, you know, alcohol or marijuana demand for alcohol or marijuana problems. And so how can we tie all of those things together? And then one added layer on top of all of that I you know, certainly prioritize in my research is understanding these things in different measurement modalities. And so we can ask somebody to report on how they feel about something. We can ask them to report about their emotions and things like that in the classic questionnaire survey. But you can also start thinking about these same types of constructs from other modalities. So what about if we capture the way that someone's brain responds to certain types of stimuli and use that as our quantification of some, you know, psychological process that we think has meaning, such as reward sensitivity, incentive salience, inhibitory control, these types of things. And then how do we get the self-report and the brain measures to actually talk to each other? Right. So we know that there's, you know, literally since the 50s, we've known that there's been issues relating kind of reports in different modalities. So self-report versus physiologic variables. We know they don't relate super well to each other. So if you go back and you read Campbell and Fiss' 1959 paper, I think it was in Psych Bulletin. I could be wrong on that, but certainly in 1959, yeah. They've been talking about these issues for, you know, what is that, coming up on 70 years,
yeah.
Yeah. So we've known about these issues. We haven't really gotten a lot better at solving them, but it's certainly of interest because we know that drugs that you know, can be misused certainly have direct effects on neural circuitry. We know that both from animal models and human models. I think the large unanswered question to me is the degree to which are drugs actually causing that altered neurocircuitry, or is it actually a predisposed risk factor that is passed from parent to child that you're actually seeing pre-drug use? And so some of my work, actually my dissertation work, will certainly touch on this, looking at what's called a co-twin control design to try to tease apart this question. So we can get into that later. But, you know, I think that all of these questions at the end of the day, for me, kind of come back to a research program that's trying to understand a truly comprehensive account across units of measurement modalities and things of that nature, all the way from, you know, genetics all the way up through the phenotype that we care about, you know, i.e. addiction, and trying to tie all of those together in a tractable way that we can kind of improve prevention efforts.
Well, that sounds super legit. Yeah. And I totally feel you too. Cause I think of some of my work as trying to, I get really deep in like an individual and try to quantify a person at different levels, right? Like, yeah, within person behavior, like moments to moments or within day, or you can get all the way up to like between people. And I see yours is even telescoped even further out than that, right? Like you can get back to parent to child, quantification all the way down to like individual responses in a person's brain when you show them this one picture. Right.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And that allows us to really get this comprehensive kind of look at a person so that we can quantify and observe kind of individual difference factors that give rise to risk, and things like that. And so I think your work is super important in this way. And I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about some of your work, as it relates to some reward sensitivity and things like this. That's a lot of my work is adjacent to that. And so I'm always interested in your papers when they come out, because I always think they're like hot off the presses, super cool work in the zone. And you got anything cooking right now that I should just be like salivating over? Cause I'm always waiting on my cool scholar alert right now.
Yeah. I got some things for you, man. I got some heat for you. No, I appreciate that, Noah. Yeah. So, you know, reward sensitivity is certainly, I think, one of my near and dear to my research heart. I think that it is often underappreciated and not paid enough attention to. So, you know, when we're talking about reward sensitivity, we're thinking about kind of individual differences in the sensitivity and capacity to respond to some sort of external or internal reinforcing property of something. Right. And so we think of drugs being certainly we are all sensitive to these rewards because they act directly on kind of like your dopaminergic systems in the brain. Right. And as well as other systems as well. But we think of these things as very rewarding in terms of the experience. But we can also think about kind of a class that I like to call natural rewards. So these are things that we would think of as, you know, kind of from a, you know, it doesn't even necessarily have to be an evolutionary standpoint per se. But these are things that like our brains are just fine tuned for. So social reward, we are a very social species. We're very close to other people. It feels good when, you know, you're on Facebook and you get a like, right? Like that is a small source of social reward, that we've gotten some sort of kind of approval, from another human. And certainly the closer we are to these people, the more rewarding it is. You can think of, I know Noah, you recently became a father. Congratulations on that. That's a certain form of social reward. Right. Is that the reinforcing properties of your baby smiling at you is certainly rewarding. So we can think of these things as natural rewards. And you kind of set up this almost competition when we think about what is addiction. Is at the end of the day, addiction is about this pathological pursuit of a drug reward at the direct expense of these natural rewards, particularly social rewards. I just keep coming back to that because it's kind of simple, but there are other types of natural rewards as well. You think about exercise can be naturally rewarding, career success, all sorts of other things. But, you know, when you get down to the brass tacks, you're talking about the drug itself and pursuit of that drug becomes wanted and liked to a degree that you are willing to forgo other normal, quote unquote, sources of reward. Things that maybe we would deem as more socially acceptable. Sometimes there's certainly a lot of kind of evaluative statements right. That people will put on it. But you know, these types of rewards that we would think of that our brains are naturally fine tuned towards. And so I think that for me, how I conceptualize my work on reward sensitivity is we really need to understand both pieces. So there's not just how much do you like drugs? That's not what addiction is really about. Certainly, I certainly understand there are individual differences in that capacity in the, you know, neural reactivity to the drug itself. But I think a huge determinant of a lot of substance use is really the availability and responsivity to other sources of reward. Because the thing that animal models oftentimes, not always, there are plenty of animal models that do this, but oftentimes our understanding of addiction is built off of animal models that do not actually adequately model the human experience. Because if you put a rat in a cage and you, let's say you specifically a Skinner box, and you're doing an operant conditioning paradigm, and the only reward in town is cocaine, that rat is going to use some cocaine.
Gonna do right? cocaine. Yeah.
And so if you give the rat another rat, or you know, wheels to run on, toys to play with, whatever else, they oftentimes will choose those other sources of reward. So we saw this in the quote-unquote rat park studies back in the late 70s, early 80s. You know, we've seen that rats will readily choose other sources of rewards if given them. And if we think about it, this is a critical, critical animal to the human translation piece, is that humans always have other sources of reward available. They may be harder to get to for some people than others. Our society, unfortunately, will sometimes systematically disenfranchise certain people from being able to access a lot of sources of natural reward. But nonetheless, all humans have other sources other than drugs available. So we need to update our understanding of the rewarding properties of drugs to be in that context. So sorry, that was a long way of getting around to, I think, why I think reward sensitivity is so important.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my work has focused on that. So, you know, I have actually my first psychology paper ever published was, you know, with Jim Murphy and the crew at Memphis looking at this availability of non-drug rewards and how that related in pretty monotonic fashion to increasing severity of alcohol use disorder. So basically, the harder it was for you to access natural sources of reward in your environment, the more severe your alcohol use disorder symptomatology was.
Right.
And more importantly, this was independent from depression, because we know that not doing naturally enjoyable mm-hmm. things also might make you feel depressed, certainly understandably. But this was independent of that association. And so there seems to be something very specific about kind of difficulty accessing reward and alcohol use disorder. But then I've taken kind of, I've stepped back a bit recently and really been trying to think deeply about reward sensitivity. And one aspect of it is access. So can you actually access these rewards? But a second aspect is, if you access them, how good are they to you? Do they actually feel good for you to obtain a natural source of reward? Because if it doesn't actually feel good for you to do that, then it's not going to be an adequate protection against the very reinforcing and rewarding properties of drug use. And so I started thinking about it, and I started wondering, can humans actually self-report on their sensitivity to reward? I think this is something that we jump way past in psychology research all the time. You always assume that you can get a human to self-report on anything, and you can, but is that thing actually the thing that you think you're measuring? And so that's where I think neuroscience research can really help us out here. When you think about sensitivity of reward, you can't, it's one of those things like color perception. Like, I can try to describe color perception to you, right, for what I see as blue, but I've never experienced anyone else's color perception. And so the intensity or the hue, I'm not trying to get all philosophical here, like, is my blue your red or anything, but just like small properties of the color blue, like how intense it is.
Well,
like, where is the line between blue and green, like those types of things.
Well, and absolutely, and that's like that's I think a real concern. It's a visual perception, right? But I mean, when you start talking about something like the strength or phenomena of alcohol, for example, you know, the phenomenological experience of it. I mean, we're talking about something that's like far more complex than just the visual understanding of the color blue. There
Absolutely.
Are far more processes. And so, mm-hmm. and we know pretty well that people experience pain on different levels. And absolutely. I think point taken is that when we expect someone to answer a 1 to 5 Likert, or I guess Likert scale is technically like 1 to 9 or something. But when they fill out a Likert scale questionnaire, how do we know that everyone who puts a seven is referring to the same seven, essentially.
Absolutely. I am just one real quick sidebar. Did you know that it's actually pronounced liquor, not liquor?
I did. I refused to pronounce it that way.
I refuse to as well.
I refuse to pronounce anything liquor. I mean, shout out to that family. Like, they did a lot for the field, and I'm sorry. I just can't do it.
Train has left the station.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I just lived. That's my lived experience. You know, like, I just can't get into it. No, I completely agree. I think these things are like super crucial, right, to our understanding of these things. And a lot of my work looks at like the emotional part of that, right? Like a lot of my findings keep finding that low positive emotional functioning is this risk factor in risk for development of substance use, for maintenance of substance use disorder, for relapse and substance use disorder treatment. And I view that as like an emotional analog to all the stuff that you're just talking about right here.
Right.
And in my view, the way to do that is to create like person-centered models, right? Where it's about the deviance from a person's own mean, right? And that allows us to mathematically at least like accommodate some of these, like your seven is my five. But I think it's about, we have to be able to create the infrastructure scientifically, mathematically, and methodologically to be able to link these phenomena in the way that you're talking about, right? So zoom in on like what's going on with a person's brain activity, I think is like a crucial first step when we're talking about reward. People are talking about how your brain lights up, right? Like,
yep.
And so to be able to zoom in on that and then systematically link that all the way down to the experience of somebody who's answering a survey somewhere in the world right now about the positive emotion functioning, for instance, when we're talking about reward, I think is such a crucial scientific groundwork just to answer any kind of complex questions about human behavior. And so it sounds like that's where you're kind of going with some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll talk about another paper in just a second, but where we wanted to start with was exactly that, is let's go ahead and let's work out the brain stuff. And fortunately, that's already been worked out for us. So there's actually great depression researchers that we can kind of borrow from here. So if we want to try to get an index of natural reward at a neurophysiological level, so I use EEG a lot, electroencephalogram, and you can quantify what are called event-related potentials. So you do this computer task. In this case, we chose a gambling task. It's pseudo gambling, unbeknownst to the participant. Choices are fixed because we are trying to actually parameterize a task where we can actually isolate what is the same for everybody. So we start to fix amount and how often you win, right? Magnitude of win, and things like that. So it's a very simple paradigm. It's called the doors task. And so you have two doors and you instruct the participant, hey, choose which one of these two doors you think a reward is behind. And if you win, you win 50 cents in this version of the task. And if you lose 25 cents. The amounts aren't the same, just going back to, there's a whole body of work on kind of loss aversion, and roughly losses feel twice as bad as wins magnitude wise. And so that's why it's balanced that way. And so you get this brain response. It happens pretty quickly. Typically it peaks around 250 or so milliseconds. So a quarter of a second, very fast when you find out whether your choice led to you winning or to you losing. And so you just get this little green arrow that points up or this little red arrow that points down. And then you look at the difference in how your brain reacts to when you've won something versus when you've lost something. And the magnitude of that difference we know tracks really, really well with depression. And it's specifically kind of like this melancholic features of depression. I have a paper in psychophysiology with my group down here where we looked at, you know, this is specifically tracking with dysthymia or persistent depressive disorder type symptoms and depressive PD.
And so, Keenan, this is just to clarify, this would be like, so this would be someone who maybe had less of a response when they got positive feedback. Is that right?
Yep. So yeah, the smaller brain response associated with winning versus losing, that's what's associated with greater dysthymia. And so, you know, I thought about something like that. That's a very basic seemingly dispositional type tendency, if it's tracking with dysthymia and not current MDD severity, we're thinking of something long lasting, something trait like. And so, you know, I wanted to look at that in relation to severity of substance use disorder. And sure enough, you get the same picture as the access, right. Paper that I mentioned, where greater severity of substance use is associated with lower, reward sensitivity, as measured neurophysiologically. And what was really important to me in this paper, was that was actually superseded by this interaction with what we call inhibitory control or disinhibition. And the reason that was important is a lot of self-report models of reward sensitivity. We can totally debate what's the correct construct network for reward sensitivity, but in my view, reward is very separate from something like cognitive control. And yet in the self-report domain, if you make somebody self-report on, let's say, impulsivity or disinhibition, and you also make them self-report on how sensitive they are to rewards, those end up being decently highly correlated, because you get some sort of like novelty seeking type aspect because of the types of questions that you might ask. You know, for example, if you ask something about driving a car really fast, right, that might get a little bit at something maybe like an intense reward, but it also kind of gets at this risk-taking. Right. And that's kind of a separate neurobiological system. One's like a stopping system, right? Like, can I stop myself from doing something impulsive? And one's like a go system that's like, yeah, I really liked doing that. Let me do it again. And to me, I just think that those should probably be, you should seek to separate those, because they're kind of mapping onto different kind of psychological processes. One is more of a stopping and one is more of a going. And so, you know, in the self-report domain, you can't really separate those as well as you might want to. But neurophysiologically, this RuP, this reward positivity measure that's derived, from the EEG task, that is quite separate from disinhibition. It correlated, you know, I think 0.08, if I remember, maybe 0.1, something like that. With the disinhibition scale. So, you know, really not correlated at all. And those two interacted. So if you had low reward sensitivity, so you weren't really getting a lot out of these natural rewards, and you had high disinhibition, which is that you were having trouble, like you have low inhibitory control, you have trouble controlling impulses and things of that nature. If you're simultaneously high on disinhibition and low on reward sensitivity, that's what produced the most substance problems. And I think that is the story that I kind of construct in my head when I think about reward sensitivity. If you aren't sensitive to rewards, you're likely going to be depressed, because it doesn't feel good to go through life without that. But the critical piece is, do you use alcohol or other drugs to cope with that depression? You feel bad, drugs bring you a good feeling. Can you stop yourself from misusing the drugs? And if you don't have that cognitive control piece, that inhibitory control piece, to where you don't feel good because you're not getting a lot of natural sources of reward, and you're simultaneously low in executive control or cognitive control, then you're going to have trouble controlling that use, maybe as a self-medication, potentially, for that depressivity that you're experiencing. And so I think that's exciting and a relatively understudied piece, is trying to understand how do these two relatively separate neurobiological systems intersect with one another when we're thinking about reward. You have a reward system, cognitive control system. How do those intersect with one another to predict, you know, the phenotype that we care about, in this case, addiction? And so I think that anytime that we talk about reward sensitivity, we also got to start bringing into the picture this other, like, executive control, cognitive control, inhibitory control, whatever you'd like to call it, that piece that's about kind of the top-down stopping type piece needs to get brought into the story. So that's some of the stuff I'm working on right now. I have an extension, kind of replication extension in the works, using functional neuroimaging of that same effect, and it's the exact same thing. We won't get into it because it's not published yet. But you know, we find the exact same interaction. You know, you look at nucleus accumbens activation being lower in anticipation of reward, and combine that with someone who is high in disinhibition or low in that inhibitory control construct, that produces the same high substance outcomes in a very large sample, you know, and it's well over 1,000 there. And so, you know, that's, be on the lookout for that, Noah. You can get a Google Scholar alert about it whenever I find some time to finish that paper. But that's what's on the horizon there.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that one because that lines right up with a paper that the group that when I was at Brown, that we published in Clinical Psych Science that showed that teens who are in substance use treatment, that if teens had lower like executive functioning or like working memory specifically, that those individuals experienced more craving during earlier recovery than individuals that were higher, right? And so it's basically like they're hot on the gas and their brake don't work right. Right. And so it just doesn't line up the way that you might think. And so when they have these kind of hot moments, right, like where they're experiencing intense craving or some other type of emotional response to their environment, their brake pedal is just like really ready to go. And when they pump the brakes, not much is happening. Right.
Yeah. Yep.
And so the ability to be able to hold on to those skills and to apply them meaningfully, right, is kind of inhibited by inhibitory control deficits, right?
Absolutely.
Not to double dip on the inhibitory right there, right? But that's kind of lines up with what you're seeing there. And so I think that's what's super interesting, right? And so like you kind of see it cross-cutting these different ways, right? Like we did it with a self-report on EMA for craving and then like some working memory tasks as part of like the Woodcock-Johnson and things like that, which are just kind of performance tasks for those who don't know on like intelligence and other cognitive functioning domains of human behavior. And so that's really interesting that it lines up this way. And I'm psyched to hear that you also got like some brain scan in there, right? Because a lot of times it doesn't always line up perfectly this way, right? When you do the EEG and the MRI data don't always line up exactly the right way. And so you know that there's real signal there.
Right. Well, and it comes down to what you're talking about earlier, Keenan, the multi-trait, multi-method stuff with Campbell and Fisk. And you would just hope to see maybe to varying degrees, right? You would hope to see the same relationships between two different constructs. And you would hope to see that this relationships between the same construct done in different ways as well. Really, really cool stuff. And it also explains sort of, and this is a term, I'm not sure if it's used too frequently anymore, but clinically, I think important phenomenon of acrasia, which is this sort of like doing what you don't want to do, or feeling compelled almost to do something that you feel otherwise, that you would like to not do, but that you feel driven to do. It sounds like some of this is this idea of not having high enough reward sensitivity for these natural rewards that you're discussing. On the one hand, having high, not high sensitivity, but maybe the right amount for drugs because they're just so powerful and rewarding. And then this sort of inability to stop that pursuit, maybe in moments where you all of a sudden, realize or think, or maybe a spouse or a significant other or something tells you, hey, this needs to stop. You have trouble stopping.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's exactly it. And I think that, you know, all of this kind of, connecting up with Noah's EMA work, I just recently started a grant period on a R36 grant from National Institute on Drug Abuse, where we're looking at these things in EMA format. So, you know, just real briefly to give you guys an outline of that project, I'm quite excited about it. So it's looking at engagement in these natural rewards throughout the day, several times a day on EMA, ecological momentary assessment. So on your smartphone, you know, when you wake up and, you know, a few times, you know, throughout the day, you might answer about what you're doing, you know, and did you engage in any of these natural sources of rewards, so social, community, leisure activities, exercise, these types of things. And then, of course, on your substance use, your craving, your demand for substance use, you know, for the alcohol purchase task as well as cigarette purchase task. And somebody needs to make a good vaping purchase task. So just a plug for that. somebody needs to figure it out. Not me, but somebody else.
That sounds like a mission for Adam Leventhal. Shout out, Adam, if you're listening.
Right.
Or maybe one of the people at Brown who's been making a couple of the different purchase tests, like Liz Aston, if you're listening, we need a
Yeah. Speaking of Adam Loventhal, just quick plug, we'll be having him on the show in a couple months. So just keep on the lookout. Glad you mentioned his name, Noah. Sorry, Keaton.
No, you're good. You're good. So, you know, they're going to answer these, you know, questions and, of course, about their substance use throughout the day. And so the question becomes is, you know, on the individual level. So on average, we know that on average, if you engage in more substance-free rewarding activities, these natural rewards, you have lesser substance use. But within person, so day to day, if relative to your own average of engaging in these activities, if you engage in fewer of them, does that lead to more substance use? It provides a direct test of this hypothesis that maybe there's a potentially causal association there. You know, is it essentially like an opportunity cost that if you do one, you don't do the other? But then additionally, before they do this EMA, we're having them come into the lab and do these same reward paradigms. So we have one for, you know, the same exact one that I described with the doors. But then we also have other ones that are other types of rewards, including like, you know, a drug-related visual stimuli, and get brain reactivity to all of these. So here's the question, right? So on average, we know that hypothetically, let's say my main hypotheses work out, right? That you engage, let's say, in more substance-free activities up until like 6 p.m. that day, let's say. And then at 9 p.m. when we assess your substance use, you have less drinks. Let's just stick with alcohol for now. And, you know, if that's the case, that if you engage in more activities, that you drink less, the critical question becomes is, what if you don't have the neural capacity to enjoy those activities, exactly. Right? So if we get this neural measure of reward sensitivity at baseline, right, and you have a small reward positivity, that event-related potential component that is reflecting your sensitivity to rewards, neurally speaking, if you have a small one of those and you engage in what would be normatively enjoyable, right, if it doesn't feel very good, that probably isn't going to provide much of a buffer to pursue a more intense form of reward that is a direct pharmacologic reward, right? The alcohol or drug use. And so I'm really excited about testing that hypothesis because, I mean, it really gets to the crux of things is we might recommend, for example, like Stacey Daughters is doing a lot of work on a kind of BA-like interventions for substance use. Obviously, Jim Murphy and his crew are definitely doing a lot of work on kind of these alternative substance-free activities and whatnot. And we're recommending that people do these things to reduce their substance use. But what about the folks who don't have the neural architecture to process those substance-free rewards? Is it actually protective for them anymore? And so I need to know. You know, we really need to know if we're going to rely on interventions on these.
The stuff that you just talked about, like the inability to have the, you know, physiological architecture to experience reward like others do, let's say, right? So a between person's difference, right? It has a word, right? It's called anhedonia, right? It's called anhedonia, which is a state of pleasurelessness where you don't experience pleasure from naturally occurring rewards in your environment like other people, or maybe like you used to even, right? If you're talking about like, stuff that happens with neural adaptations as a function of chronic use, like in the allostasis model, shout out George Kube, which is a rodent model, right? And we haven't really ever confirmed it totally in a human model, right? And so some of this stuff would give us that in addition to it, but that stuff gets in the way in treatment all the time. Like I work with teens all the time and I'm like, hey, let's do this thing like that you think is fun. Like, let's go to the skate park, dude. And he's like, I went and it was still lame and you're lame and I'm out. Right. And it's because they don't have the raw materials, right, to experience positive emotion and reward in the way, because it's just not there depending on how what's gone on in their dopaminergic systems, whether that's something that set them in motion towards this path or a function of chronic use. The destination is the same, right? And so in like in R21 that I'm doing right now, or that I have under review, if anybody's listening, please help me get this thing because I'm really interested in it. Is to do pharmacotherapy for people to help them get the raw materials back to experience reward in this way so that maybe we can help in those risky moments where a person can actually do these things and have the raw materials to engage with the interventions like we're talking about, right? And so I think it's super, this is super crucial stuff because it ties together a lot of literatures, right, that have kind of never talked to each other, right? Yep. In meaningful ways, at least, right? And it's kind of leaned into some jingle jangle fallacy. For those people who don't know what jingle jangle fallacy is, which is where we have two names for the same thing or a single name that's two separate things. That happens a lot in our field, right? And so trying to get all these people to talk together with a systematic way so that we can kind of produce positive outcomes, whether that be prevention work for at-risk individuals because of their genetic history, right, or their lived history, or just perhaps some contextual factors, like there's nothing available in their environment, like some of Adam Leventhal's work, for instance, right, shows that individuals who don't have access to this kind of stuff experience more anhedonia, right, which is kind of what you're talking about here. Right. And, or if it's from a treatment context, which is kind of where I come into contact with it, which is this stuff is all happening inside of an individual who's trying to make changes to their behavior. And so to understand how this is going on and then to ask them to do an intervention that their biology is not compatible with is just like ridiculous. Right. And so we have to understand a person at all these different levels so that we can make sure that we engage with them in ways that are going to be able to help them move towards where they want to go versus confirm that they can't go anywhere than where they are.
Well, I think, I agree with all that. And I think, Keenan, another thing that your work is doing, which maybe explicitly, maybe not, I'm not sure, but is sort of separating out the different parts of reward functioning more generally. Because like, you know, we've done this really well with, although I just saw Justin Strickland and Matt Johnson write a paper about how impulsivity is not a construct. So that's a
I invite you to scroll down in the comments to Kevin King's comment on that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just for anybody who is familiar with the Twitter string that we're referring to that happened today. But by the time this drops, you hopefully have read the paper and then it'll be a more thoughtful conversation.
Right. Yeah. I think,
not just the abstract.
I think we'll see where that all goes. But I guess all that to say that like impulsivity and a lot of these more cognitive constructs have been really well defined and really well separated out and, into these different groups. And for reward sensitivity, reward functioning more generally, I mean, that just has not been done. Cause there are things like access to rewards, like reward availability. Yeah. There's reward, like sensitivity to the reward. You know, there are these different parts. And what you'll be able to see with your EMA data is both just this sort of electrophysiological measure of reward sensitivity. But then you'll also get reward availability, maybe not as much reward availability, but reward engagement, which is, you know, is that separate? Is that meaningfully separate? Or is that, one in the same thing with reward sensitivity? Is one based on the other? I think being able to parse that out a lot is really important. It sounds like your work is sort of uniquely situated to answer some of those questions as well.
Yeah, I'm absolutely trying to do that. I think, because I think that it really, at the end of the day, it impedes progress for prevention and treatment work if we don't separate these things. So, you know, it's something that we oftentimes take for granted, but totally, Sam, you look at if people don't separate reward sensitivity from motivation to obtain reward, mm-hmm. from reward availability, from reward engagement, right? Like all of these things are all like slightly,
and they're all functionally different.
Yeah. And that's different. Even before you took, consumed it, right? Like all that happened up to the moment where it went in,
right?
Or where your body responded, right? Like, all that's anticipatory pre-reward in consumption, if you will, for lack of a better term, even if we're talking about like naturally occurring rewards, right? Then there's the how your biology responds once it's been activated. How long does that hang out with you? Right. Yep. Right. And then like, what is the fall that happens after that? I think all that stuff is crucial. Right. And I actually think that individuals who use for positive reinforcement, for instance, that there are different characteristic profiles of individuals. Like some people just don't respond when you give them a reward. Some people, they respond great, but it just like goes away as quick as it came. They don't have the ability for it to, it doesn't stay. Right.
Yeah.
And all of those have different intervention points. All of those have totally different biological, psychological, and behavioral processes associated with them.
Yeah.
Right. And to disentangle that is huge. And adding EMA as a, I'm obviously biased, EMA researcher, right, allows you both to do it within person and between person. Because which a lot of times these things switch sign across those levels. Like in my work, we systematically find that individuals are more likely to use on a day when that's characterized by high positive emotions earlier in the day before they used.
Yep.
But at the person level, so the trait level, people who have lower positive emotions than others are more likely to use or use more than others, right? And so it flips sign right there, right? And so it's there's something about that, that operationalizing those constituent parts of the reward process, that's going to be like so valuable, in my opinion. Once again, I'm obviously like incredibly biased for so many reasons.
No, I totally agree, man. And you know, when you get into the EMA world, you know, this grant is my first foray into EMA, and you know, I'm very fortunate to have great consultants on this grant. You know, just shout out Aiden Wright, you know, Jim Murphy and Tim Truhl. You know, super glad to be working with these guys. You know, with their EMA experience. But you know, one thing that is very critical is also the time at which you assess mm-hmm. these things in EMA. So great paper by I am forgetting her first name, but Hamaker as her last name. Certainly she's doing great work and kind of more quant heavy points of the field. Yes, Ellen, thank you. She just put out a great paper about essentially like talking about effects that we think about within subject. So we've already done the complicated switch from nomothetic, you know, type span to, well, within subject can still be certainly nomothetic as well. But, you know, going from that between to within subject piece, you know, you then start to ask the question of how far apart mm-hmm. are your measurement time points? Because right. if I measure something that, for example, let's pretend that stress and craving have a 30-minute delay. All right. So you're stressed out and 30 minutes later, you actually start craving. If I measure a bunch of times throughout the day, let's say every hour, and we try to look at a lagged effect, right, at time T minus one for stress to craving, you won't find it.
It might have
or at least
out.
It'll be confounded.
Right.
But if you do it concurrently, you'll see a big effect. And you might conclude that stress doesn't precede negative affectivity. But it only didn't precede negative affectivity because of the time scale you looked at, mm-hmm. right? And so the concurrent effect within subject also subsumes the lagged effects that you have not sampled at a high density enough frequency to find. But we often aren't looking at those. We only say, oh, if it's lagged, it's either lagged or not, right? Based on whatever right. frequency we sampled at. And so EMA, I think, is going to be a great tool for the field. It is definitely in its infancy. There's a lot of very basic statistical psychometric questions that I think we got to really work hard on and not kind of put the cart before the horse on right. To ask about some of these things. And, you know, Ellen Hamaker's work on, she was talking about kind of continuous time functions that you might think about something, a continuous lagged effect across different time scales being nonlinear and how it drops off in terms of its prospective effect within subject. That stuff I think is going to be where we end up in 5 to 10 years, certainly doing EMA work as well as other advancements. But I think there's a lot of promise there to answer some of these questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the processes that we care about operate on feedback loops as well. And so,
mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, I think it's very important to study the full loop instead of cross-sectionally or over maybe large swashes of time. Keenan, thank you so much for walking us through all of your research. I mean, that was phenomenal. And you've only been in the field for, you know, a handful of years and have already done so much thoughtfully thinking about incredible problems. Obviously, have had great mentorship. And you have a few great mentors on your current project. But I'm really looking forward to seeing the rest of your career and just seeing the impact that you have on the field, but also on people's lives. So thank you, Keenan.
Thanks, Sam. I really appreciate that, man. Very nice of you to say.
Keenan, it's been so great talking about all these things. If we had to take your research work and some of the other things that we've talked about and and apply them to specific stakeholders who listen to the podcast. We do this thing at the end where we like to just kind of take like bite-sized chunks of all the stuff that we talked about and offer it up for people who are specific stakeholders. If you had, what would you say about your work that people in recovery or family members of individuals in recovery should walk away from our conversation about, or with rather?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that for folks in recovery and family members of folks in recovery, I think it is a fairly prevalent feature of addiction that the experience with, the availability of, access to, and experience of non-drug rewards are just huge determinant of recovery success. And I think that structuring a meaningful life that involves things that you enjoy, not just things that you're responsible for or career success or anything else, but also an enjoyable life outside of alcohol or drug use, I think is just so critical. And I think it will aid in success of recovery efforts. And for family members, providing those opportunities that are intensely enjoyable for your family member who is struggling and working their tail off. They, trust me, they want to quit. If they are quitting, it's hard to do. And so the motivation is there, and give them some reprieve from the hard work of recovery and do something enjoyable with them. That's what I would say.
Yeah. Thanks, Keenan. What about for clinicians?
For clinicians, I would actually say something very similar.
Yeah, it right? Sounds like
it's
it.
Almost the same thing. I think for clinicians, it would be good to be aware of the things that you're telling your clients to do. And this is obviously maybe in the future clinics can go ahead and just send all their clients to somebody with an EEG system and assess some pre-treatment characteristics. But you know, in lieu of that, be aware that like different people have individual differences in how enjoyable the things that you're telling them to do instead of using substances are. And you have to be aware of that, that you can't just tell somebody to try harder or to do more. You got to find the activities that are going to be enjoyable enough as an alternative to substance use for your client to be successful.
Now that's a super great point. What would you say to policymakers out there if they're listening?
Oh, policymakers, I would say that you can institutionalize these policies that give people options. I love when I see a new YMCA pop up in the middle of a more impoverished neighborhood. I love to see boxing gyms, parks, playgrounds, all of these things that we collectively as a society know provide these opportunities for recreation and enjoyment. Invest in your community. Not only will your community appreciate and be happier, I do believe that it will lead to decreased substance use rates.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some good work, the Icelandic model, which is cool. It's, I don't know the first name, but Christensen, some really cool work. So, listeners, if you're interested, look that up. Last one, how does your work speak to sort of like underrepresented groups?
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't get a chance to talk about it as much, but, you know, I definitely have some work on kind of neighborhood effects and kind of how experiences with, you know, access to particularly like healthcare and, you know, other types of resources intersect with a lot of these factors. So that, you know, it's in the works. Go ahead, Noah, set your Google Scholar alerts. but that's in the works. I would say that, you know, also advocate for the politicians who care about you, who want to invest in your communities, who want to provide services, you know, that would enable access to some of these types of things that we've been talking about here. Vote for them and hold them accountable to that. Don't just vote because there's a D next to their name, but because they're going to follow through on what they have promised to you and your community.
Yeah, that's so huge. That's so huge. And the last thing that we ask is, we got a lot of trainees that listen to the podcast, and you've been wildly successful You've had some really great mentorship along the way, and I was wondering if you'd pay it forward a little bit and drop any pearls of wisdom that you might have, advice for trainees out there. You got anything that you're willing to drop?
Absolutely. So one thing that I have learned in grad school is, one, you need to get on academic Twitter. You need to get there immediately. I'm not joking. If you're listening to this and you don't have an academic Twitter, make one, follow me, follow Noah, follow Sam, and then follow the people that we follow. It's an amazing resource. I cannot tell you the number of times that I have found code. I have found solutions to problems that I've been having research-wise on Twitter, and I'll solve it and I'll bring it to my advisor the next week. And he literally, like, a real conversation that we regularly have is, where did you learn that? And I genuinely tell him Twitter. And for the first like 5 or 6 times I told him that, he thought I was making a joke that he didn't understand. And then he was like, oh, you're actually finding these things on Twitter. And so I was like, get on there. One of the things I learned while I was on Twitter, among the many things, is something that Aiden Wright, he's a professor at Pitt, said, is he compared your academic journey to being like a small business. And that small business is you. It is your mind. It is your skills that you are developing. And it is very useful to think about your grad school as you are growing a small business. When you first start a business, will there be weeks where you need to work more than 40 hours a week? Absolutely, there will be. That is not unique to academia. That also exists in many other sectors in society. If you need to work 80, 100 hours a week just to keep your business afloat 5 years into having your business, that business is struggling for some reason. It may not even be your fault, right? You may be in the wrong sector. Maybe you have competitors that are knocking you out. Whatever it is, it indicates a problem with the business model, right? So I'd say think about things through that lens. You're not writing papers for the sake of writing paper. Everybody can write a paper. I always conceptualize it as like, they're letting me do this as an undergrad going into grad school. If this was actually important, they would not let me do this. Like, there's no way, right? And so, like, writing papers is good. It's absolutely the way that we communicate with other scientists. Getting a paper published is not the end all be all. We're working towards a common goal in science of this truth concept of advancing scientific knowledge in some domain. And that's the goal. It's not to publish another paper, it's to learn. And so every time you learn something, it's like you just ordered a new product that you're going to offer in your business. You now have a new thing to sell, right, to other folks. And if you build a big enough, successful enough business with many products and all this, you know, this, that, and the other businesses are going to, or other individuals are going to want to invest in your business, right? And so I think at the end of the day, think about that analogy, and really you can push it to a pretty far extent before it falls apart. But that is what you're doing, is you're creating a business, and that business is your mind. So don't cut corners. Don't just try to just like have the low hanging fruit of just getting another paper published. Yes, that is good. You should celebrate those, because there's a lot of rejections that come in this business as well. Celebrate every paper acceptance, but don't let that be the end for you. Understand the methods that you're using. Don't learn them just enough what buttons to click in SPSS, process model 648 to give you the model that, you know, you need to get published. Understand what that model is doing. Understand what your statistics are and what they mean. What does that number mean? Get in there, you know, roll up your sleeves. And I think that will make a much, not just a much more successful career, but a much more meaningful career for you. You'll enjoy a lot more what you do day to day. I have tons of fun doing my work. It can be hard at times, but it's rewarding because at the end of the day, I'm investing in myself and I'm getting paid to do it. You can't beat that. You can't beat getting paid to learn. So don't lose sight of that. Don't exchange the good for the great. The great for the good, right? Focus on the things that really will matter 5-10 years from now. Yeah. And that's what I'd recommend.
Next week on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, we're going to have another episode with Keenan Joyner. Keenan this time is going to talk about specific approaches to increase representation and shore up the leaky pipeline in addiction psychology training programs.